coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody is doing well. Hope everybody's had a great week. Been looking forward to tonight's episode for a while. In the second part, we will be joined by our good friend and researcher, Jason McLean. We'll be talking about end times. We'll be talking about passages from the Bible that discuss end times and really breaking into those and getting into the world around us and what's happening. And speaking of that, that is our first part tonight, is what's happening in the world. I mentioned a week ago, Easter Monday, we lost Pope Francis. And I mentioned that following Tuesday, that next night, that we would be doing an episode on papal prophecy, on Nostradamus and what he said about, quite possibly about this Pope's death. And it's interesting, it's fascinating, but never forget, folks, we are here not to sensationalize on this show, but to demystify these things to the general public, you know, especially when it comes to the church and tradition, things like that. There are a lot of things that are nebulous to the general public, and especially whenever it comes to spirituality and the church, things like that. I'm always glad to bring aboard people like our good friend, Archbishop James Cloud. He is the author of Walking with Ghosts, an exorcist memoir of the paranormal. He's been on the show numerous times talking about exorcism, talking also about end time prophecies, things like that, the prophecies of Malachi even, which we will get into a little bit tonight. Welcome back to the show, Archbishop. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic, man. It's always great to talk with you. I'm so glad to hear that you had a great Easter season with your flock, with your family. I was shocked. I was very happy to hear. I'm always happy whenever, you know, a Pope gets to address the Holy See and the people at Easter. And I was very glad that the Pope got to, but was, I guess, not extraordinarily shocked to hear that he had passed. He had been in very ill health as of the last year or so, and even spent most of the time from November to Easter in the hospital with pneumonia, all kinds of things. So it's very sad to lose Pope Francis. He was, I think, a good pope, all in all. We were talking just before the show. I think a lot of people misunderstand the papacy, especially the modern papacy. You know, there was a point of time where, yes, the Pope was like a king and ruled over kingdoms and all kinds of things and held all kinds of sway. And sure, the Pope still holds some political sway. But if you notice, everybody, the Big C Catholic Church is still rolling merrily along without the Pope in seat. So it's set up that way. It's made like the Pope is very, very much a figurehead in that kind of way, and a spiritual figurehead, sure. But it's not like he runs a whole lot of day-to-day business in that kind of way. You know, it's not like what he says goes like that anymore. So it's fascinating to see that, and it's fascinating to see how people have reacted to the Pope's death. So how have things been? How did you take the news, Archbishop? How did that affect you?
Well, I think a lot like you. You know, I wasn't shocked per se that he passed away. I mean, it seemed like it was a real sudden passing, but at the same time, like you had said, he'd been in the hospital for a while, struggling with the pneumonia and some other stuff that they were saying was going on. I mean, he even prepared his funeral while he was in the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, I think he knew what was coming. And, you know, some reports had come out that when he was in the hospital and on the point of death, even in there, you know, he saw the demonic trying to get him, you know, and take him somewhere. And even then he was fighting a spiritual battle. And so, you know, it was pretty obvious. Even the demons knew that it would be shortly time for him to pass. And so I think they were trying to either scare him or do whatever they needed to do to perhaps degrade his faith, which I doubt it did, but they do what they do. And so honestly, it was no shock. I was definitely sad. I'm sad to see anyone pass, honestly, but you know, it's sad to see a person of his position pass, because he was the Bishop of Rome and, you know, a peer in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, once again, any figurehead, any head of state, things like that, there, one of the things that I bring up regularly is the case of Ilian Gonzalez and the Pope's intervention with that, Pope John Paul II, where it was like shortly after a call from the Vatican embassy and a kid was headed home. And that's just it. Like, the Pope does still have quite a bit of political reach, things like that. So there's a lot of that. And, when it comes to the election of the Pope, that's what we're talking about, coming up very shortly. I want to say May 15th, they said that the conclave will start. So, and that's really where they start looking at the new popes, or prospective popes at that point. And it's kind of odd that it coincides right with the NFL draft, this time around, you know?
Yeah. We'll see if any of the football players get elected.
Yeah, right. That's a heck of a trade up, man.
Pretty good.
That's a high pressure game right there.
Yeah,
that is,
for sure.
That is something different.
You couldn't pay me enough to be the Pope.
You know, I have said for years, probably globally, the Pope has the most hated position in the world. You know, just hands down as far as any kind of global leader goes. And it once again, the influence of the Pope goes back, thousands of years and especially into the time of the Middle Ages, medieval times, stuff like that. And let's go ahead and use this as a launching point to get into prophecies and prophecies pertaining to the popes, because the one that's been all over the news has been Nostradamus. And you and I have chatted about Nostradamus on the show before. I think perhaps he was an amazing seer. He may have been an incredible intuitive. But I hesitate at the word prophet or prophecy with his quatrains and poetry. Because a prophet provides a way out. You know, they are there to deliver a religious message to a people. It may not always be the best message or the one that the people want to hear. But there's always an option out with a prophet where it's like, hey, if you follow this rule, this thing won't happen. You know, straighten up and you won't have brimstone raining down on you, Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, there's an option there. So let's go ahead and start breaking that down to begin with. Just the idea of, is Nostradamus a prophet or not?
In my personal opinion, I don't think he's a prophet, because one, prophets are, so in the Old Testament, a true prophet was never wrong. Mm-hmm. So if a true prophet was wrong, they were considered a false prophet, and a lot of them were stoned to death.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they took prophecy extremely seriously. If you claim to be a prophet, you'd better be 100% on the ball. Otherwise, bad things can happen. Of course, like Jeremiah, for instance, the weeping prophet. You know, he was the weeping prophet because he was always crying over what God was telling him that was coming to Jerusalem. You know, they'd be sacked and dragged off. And it broke him up. Whereas the other prophets in the school of prophets were saying, oh, everything's fine. You don't have to change nothing. You don't have to do nothing. It's totally fine. It's all gravy. And well, they were taken. And, but that's true for the prophets of today. You never want to believe anyone is speaking for God unless they're 100% accurate. Nostradamus, unfortunately, his quatrains are so nebulous, you could almost, you know, apply any quatrain to a historical event and then in hindsight say, oh yeah, he predicted that or this or whatever. I mean, even his prophecy of Hitler, World War II, you know, he named Hister, H-I-S-T-E-R, instead of Hitler. Some people would Nostradamus-splain as, instead of mansplaining, it's Nostradamus-splain. He meant Hitler. And then they bring in another random quatrain to kind of back that up. But a true prophet's going to be shooting straight from the hip. I mean, they're going to tell you what's coming, why is it coming? And like you said, if you change your ways, then God's mercy will be there and it won't occur. But it's one of those things. I personally do not believe Nostradamus was ever a prophet.
Yeah.
A seer, did he see things? Sure.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. And we actually just got into it not too long ago, got into some of his methods with Dr. John Hall and just the fact of, you know, activating meditative brainwaves with candles and ripples in water, you know, things like that, how that can actively entrain your brain the same as a flashing strobe light. You know, so it's pretty fascinating to think about the ways and methods that he used to garner these sessions, so to speak. And as somebody who, you know, practices remote viewing, it's interesting to consider that fact that perhaps he was at that point doing something akin to remote viewing. And I'll bring up on screen real quatrain that is in question from Nostradamus in the 16th century. Through the death of a very old pontiff, a Roman of good age will be elected. Of him it will be said that he weakens his seat, but long will he sit in mordant activity. So that's the quatrain that supposedly might relate to this pope. But when you bring it into focus with the prophecies of Saint Malachi and the prophecy of the popes and the black pope, things like that. It's fascinating. It is something that's like, that's interesting. Now, correlation and causation, and that's kind of a rallying cry of this show. But it is fascinating, and it's there, you know. So yeah, even the prophecies of Malachi are something that are hotly debated and highly debated within the realm of the Catholic Church. So,
yeah, and even Saint Malachi, his prophecies, his prophecy of the popes, there have been instances where he was not correct in identifying the popes that would be in succession. Now, is that because a person intervened or whatnot and elected a different pope at the time? Or, I mean, could be, you know, according to St. Malachi, the next pope would be known as Peter the Roman.
Yep.
And so, and I, interestingly enough, there's like four or five Peters that are potential candidates to be the next pope. So, like you said, correlation is not causation.
Yeah.
When it comes to these things, but it is interesting, something to keep an eye on and kind of, you know, file it in the back of your head.
Yeah.
About that.
Well, and once again, that quatrain up on screen, a Roman of good age. So even the idea of Peter the Roman, and the idea that, yes, there is an Italian up for papacy, amongst those. Yeah, I think there's three or elected. Four,
I read it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And all are Peter.
So, yeah, it's interesting to explore that idea and to think about that. But now, how do you think that relates to end times, things like that, as far as the prophecy of the popes and that kind of stuff?
Archbishop? Sure. Well, you know, a lot of people believe that the false prophet of Revelation will be a pope. Because in the book of Revelation, it talks about the false prophet who actually institutes the mark of the beast. It's not the Antichrist. People always say, yeah. Oh, Antichrist this, Antichrist that. Antichrist is the political leader. False prophet is the religious leader.
Yep.
And commands all of the people of earth to worship the beast or Antichrist. But the thing that gives a little hint on... And kind of leans towards a pope being a false prophet, the false prophet, not a, but the, is that he'll present himself like a lamb. So that is indicative of he'll present himself as if he's Christian, but he'll speak with the words of the dragon. So it'll be a deceptive, dark, people might not see it. As that, I'm sure, because Lucifer is the father of all lies. He's the epitome of, you know, mixing a little lie with the truth.
Yeah.
So that you believe in the whole deception, that the narrative that he's trying to weave. And so people need to be mindful of that. I've always been a big proponent of not looking at a man for all leadership, all truth, all etc. You know, that is solely in Christ and in the Word of God. But there are many that would look at a pope as having the words of God coming out of him, supposedly. Especially if he chooses to speak ex cathedra.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he at that point, he's infallible. Everything he says is gospel truth. So could that be? Perhaps. I'm not saying 100%, you know, that's who the false prophet is, but it makes the most sense given the historical... political power of a pope, sure. The influence of a pope. I mean, even amongst Muslims, Jews, etc., because of the what is that called? The House of God or whatnot in the Arab Emirates. Mm-hmm. It has the Catholic Church, a mosque, and a synagogue all together to foster dialogue, as they say.
Yeah.
And you have Hindus and other folks that attended the Pope's funeral because he was well-respected. So, you know, putting two and two together, it seems likely, and I won't say 100%, but likely that a Pope may not even be this next one, but a Pope is likely to be the false prophet that works alongside the political power of Antichrist.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we've covered with you before, you know, and I'll bring it up here in just a second, but there have been numerous steps, especially whenever you look at, the Jewish concept of the end times, things like that, the building of the third temple beginning, yeah, and the sacrifice of the red heifer, you know, the preparations for that. It's really interesting when you start digging into that, the fact that those preparations seem to be in full swing and in active plan.
Absolutely. And I just was earlier today, I was reading articles coming out of Israel and whatnot, and the sacrifice of the red heifer was supposedly supposed to take place this past Passover, during the Easter time. And so red heifers might already be sacrificed for all I know. But also there's a massive political push now by Netanyahu as well as Trump and Pete Hegseth to go ahead, build the third temple. So we'll have to see how that pans out. And I mean, there's a lot of things that are just layering up, it's very indicative of the beginning of the tribulation period, where you see the rise of the false prophet, the rise of Antichrist. Who those are, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But the things that are happening is very much pointing towards we're right on the precipice, if not already going over the edge into the end times.
Yeah, precisely. And that time of tribulation, especially that time beforehand where global conflict, things like that, massive earthquakes, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria, that's what we're talking about. And the idea that we may be living the time of tribulation right now. And it's possibly scary to think about, but at the same token and this is something that we discuss regularly on the show, the idea of the Book of Revelation. Will it be verbatim what the Book of Revelation is? No. That is a story told in order to give hope to those that were persecuted at the time, but will those things on a broader scope happen? Will there be a time of judgment of good and evil? Like, sure. I firmly believe that there will be an end to period all of us. And that our vibration at the end will decide whether we go to a lower dimension or a higher dimension from the one that we're in right now. Call it heaven, call it hell if you want to. But that's where I stand on it. And the idea that that good prevails despite all the horrible things. And that's really the message whenever you start looking at Daniel, whenever you start looking at 2 Peter, all of these apocalyptic texts in the Bible. And it's interesting even to look at the echoing of language from Genesis and creation into Daniel and even Ezekiel. And the same language being used, and then Ezekiel being very much echoed and copied in Revelation, to the point of even the four animals, the cherubs, things like that. Very much the same
thing. Well, there's a big secret to that. God wrote it all.
there's
one author, even though there's 66.
There's one dude who inspired all of it. Touche.
It would only make sense he'd use the same language.
Well, yeah. And even then, though, the idea that these things are beginning to play out in the world around us, quite possibly.
Yeah.
How do we, I guess, interpret and activate that in our life? Because, of course, there's going to be a good percentage of non-Christian things like that in the world that will actively be taking part in this, you know?
Sure.
How do these things play out on a global stage, and how do they play out on a global stage religiously like that?
Yeah. Good questions. You know, I was actually thinking a lot of that about that today, because of articles I'd been reading today and a few days ago as well. Because you have players, so to institute a worldwide government, you'd have to have everyone almost begging for peace, almost begging for a solitary, single governing body to oversee the affairs of different nations. One of the ways that makes the most sense to me is a global war, World War III. We see today India and Pakistan are getting into it.
Yep.
Russia, Ukraine are doing their thing. Syria is in civil war today again, even though they just had a coup and a takeover. They're again in a civil war. The nation of Israel is fighting to protect the Druze people, D-R-U-Z-E, in the southwestern part of Syria. You got Turkey that's been very antagonistic toward Israel, and the current government of Syria, from what I understand, is backed by Turkey, which again is another player. When it comes to the Psalm 83 war, as well as the war of Gog Magog, you know, everything, the political tensions right now are rife and fit perfectly with what was prophesied to happen. You got the rebuilding of the temple full force ahead. Supposedly they want to have it done and fully in place by 2029 to finish the building of it. You have the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, has all of the furniture ready for the temple, all the golden articles, all the priestly castes, you know, the Levites and everything else, everything's set. You got thousands of Jews over the past couple of years ascending the Temple Mount and praying and whatnot, and the Muslims aren't stopping them now. You got the whole climate issue, the sun's magnetic field. I was just reading not a few hours ago is weakening, which causes more disruption and chaos, causing more sunspots, more CMEs, coronal mass ejections, and flares and other stuff as its magnetic field goes wonky. Apparently, there's the Southern Atlantic atmospheric anomaly that is a big, like, dent in our magnetic field that protects us from solar rays.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's on like Donkey Kong these days.
Yeah. And, you know, the Temple Institute, once again, it's fascinating when you start looking at these things and the fact that there are people out there that are fully preparing for this stuff. No different than we have factions of people around here digging bunkers and things like that, fully preparing for this stuff, you know,
sure.
in a totally different right. And even the fact that, like, yes, I guess it was a year or two ago that red heifers were purchased from right here in Texas to send over to Israel. So It's one of those, it's knocking on door right now, these things. So the fact that they are kind of all culminating in this same period of time with, the election of a new pope, that kind of stuff. Yeah. It is really interesting to look at, and, I don't know. It's one of those. I am a deeply spiritual person, as we've talked about on the show before, Archbishop. And, it's one of those, be careful, because it's all happening as we speak, you know. It's happening and unfolding in real time. If you're paying attention, if you follow these things. And once again, you know, you can go to templeinstitute.org, all that kind of stuff. You can go and follow Times of Israel. You'll see the articles and things like that about laying groundwork for the third temple on Temple Mount, things like that. That was 2013. That article came out that I have up on screen right now. So it's, yeah, it's one of those. I've, and kind of the same way that I've said it to atheists for years who call religious crazy, you know, or religious nut jobs. And it's like, well, you know, unfortunately you're the one in the minority.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
Because the Muslim faith fully believes that this is coming.
They do.
The Jewish faith fully believes that this is coming. The prophets of Christianity, things like that, fully said that this was coming. And granted, you know, once again, looking at things through a historical lens with the Book of Revelation, that kind of stuff. You are looking at the fact of there is a long line of apocalyptic literature that is leaned on in the Book of Revelation.
Sure.
To create that, you know, a lot of previous revelation that was done by Daniel, Ezekiel, a lot of imagery that would have gone a long way with very few words, you know, as far as being, yeah, religiously and spiritually understood by the audience that it was being given to, which were basically converted Jews who had converted to Christianity who were being persecuted. So,
yeah, as well as Greeks. There were a lot of Greeks as well.
Yeah. So with that in mind, how do we begin? So what are some of the signs of the time for all of this? That's spoken of in a few different places, but what are some of the things to look out for that are signposts that should I guess technically be like shooting a flare in the air to run the opposite direction, you know? Like we said earlier, it's so.
Well, first and foremost, for people, if they want to, you know, be on the right side of history, shall we say, is to accept Christ as your savior. You know, follow him, devote yourself to him, because he said, I'm the way, the truth, the life. No one comes unto the Father except through me. Now, that negates any other prophets, any other gods that someone might say, well, all paths lead to Rome. Well, metaphorically speaking, not Rome itself, but he didn't give anyone that option when they put their faith in him. If a person says they're a Christian, they cannot have any other recourse in their mind that all paths lead to Rome, because Christ didn't leave that available to him. Even St. Paul, you know, or I believe it was St. Paul. My brain is a little bit fuzzy tonight, but said, even if an angel or another person comes preaching another gospel, don't believe them. You know, there is only one way. But as far as to view the signs as it's leading up into where we're going. So the scriptures as a whole, taking Old and New Testament into account, you have the rise of Gog Magog. Well, Gog is the leader of the old tribe known as the Magogians, which is on the Russian steppes. So Magog is Russia. Gog is the leader of Russia. Then Gog Magog have a federation with them in the end time battle, including Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Egypt. I believe it's also parts of Ethiopia, if memory serves. Of course, Syria, Gaza, ancient Philistia, where the Philistines came from. And I believe a couple of the stands. I'm not sure. I'd have to view one of the maps. But that's the federation that Magog, Russia, will have with it as it comes down to invade Israel. We see that exact federation now, as far as alliances go. Military cooperation, military pacts, etc., etc.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things holding back U.S. and Israel from attacking Iran, Russia says they'll step in and defend Iran because they're one of their buddies, mainly because of oil and trade agreements and whatnot. But the federation is still there. You've seen the belligerence of Turkey towards NATO with the whole Ukraine war. You know, Turkey's kind of played both sides, and really no one in NATO knows exactly which side Turkey is on. According to scripture, it'll be part of the Magogian invasion of Israel. You have the military alliance piece. That's in place. That's without a doubt. So you have then to look forward to Israel will rebuild a third temple. It doesn't have to be before the tribulation starts. It can be at some point during the first 3.5 years, but it has to be built by the midpoint of the 7-year period of what's known as Jacob's trouble or the tribulation. Because the tribulation itself is very focused on Israel. You know, Jacob's trouble. Jacob's name was changed by God to Israel. So when you're talking Jacob's trouble, the end times focus on Israel. That is God's timepiece. When you see Israel doing something funky, keep an eye on it. Or if someone's doing something to Israel, keep an eye on it and be mindful of the political alliances that are prophesied to be in place during the end times. Next, you have the 7-year peace deal, where the strong covenant is made by the Antichrist between Israel and other nations. It can be 2 or 3 nations, and it would still fulfill that prophecy. However, it could be quite a few of the Middle Eastern Arab nations so that they have peace. I personally think the rebuilding of the Jewish temple will be part of that peace deal so that no one fights and squabbles and carries on during their whole rebuilding process. I recently read an article that they were talking about a 7-year peace deal between Israel and, I want to say it was Hamas. I believe it was Hamas in the article. And it was being promoted by, I want to say, the United Arab Emirates, but I'm not 100% on that. It's one of those little nations. You know, it was proposed. Will it work? Who knows?
Yeah.
But it's interesting to see that it's a 7-year peace deal. Then you have the St. Peter talked about the great falling away in the church, a defection from the true gospel in favor of a more liberal, progressive gospel in the church. It's a total falling away, even a defection altogether, saying Christ is not Lord. There are many paths to God. That's part of the great falling away. It's part of that end time deception.
Mm.
And then you'll have things are happening all over the scientific world. I mean, I recently watched an article about how artificial intelligence, AI, discovered what's called the Omega Code in the very fabric of the universe. And it is almost conscious, as the researchers have found out, so that they can't go past a certain point in the quantum programming. Otherwise, it's self-down. It erases files. It's almost like God's stop sign saying, you can look this far, but you ain't going any further. Any further.
Interesting.
There's trouble. And many of the scientists that are in the quantum mechanics now, in my opinion, this sounds awful like the mind of God. They say that the universe itself is showing signs that it is conscious, that consciousness itself is in every neutron, proton, atom. Everything in the universe has a consciousness or is driven by a greater consciousness. And in my brain, I'm just going, guys, it's God. Just admit it. You're already finding the evidence for this. How is this, you know, what's stopping you at this point other than your own pride? So you got all of these things in the parts of Daniel. It says knowledge will increase at the end. Well, in 1500 years before the invention of the car, we still had horse and buggies for 1500 years. Late 1800s, we have the car. A few years later, we're flying. A couple decades later, we're hitting the moon. A couple decades later, we're messing with AI, quantum mechanics, quantum physics. We're going into the very core of everything. Tell me, knowledge isn't being increased, and it's being increased at an exponential rate. Then you see in Daniel that says people will be going to and fro all over the earth, basically. And so, yeah, planes, trains, and automobiles, we're going all over the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many things that are not only like signs pointing that we're at the end. I mean, these suckers are neon signs just flashing and just glowing up the night like the strip on in Vegas.
Yeah.
Saying, y'all better get right. Playtime is over with God. Everyone has, and at the very end, there's this great awakening spiritually as well of new converts. And you have Muslims in deeply Islamic countries where they're seeing Christ himself come to them and they're converting into Christianity. Much of Iran now is Christian because this is happening. Whole families are dreaming the same dreams of Isa, you know, Jesus, coming to them and saying, hey, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Follow me. And they do. And then you have, you know, massive conversions occurring all over the earth now. You have massive revivals going on across the nation in the United States where people are getting baptized. I mean, the Catholic Church even recently posted that the baptisms and conversions to the faith are just off the charts right now. And honestly, I personally feel that that is God's last attempt to reach who he can before he finally just says, your will be done, and off we go.
You know, I will definitely say that there is a want of connection with a lot of people that I don't think that there was before. Father. It's really interesting to look at it. I'm not going to say that it's a hugely desperate want of connection, but it's one that this and I say it regularly in reference to paranormal communities, UFO UAP communities, things like that, that there is a want of confirmation married with confirmation bias that sometimes converge on the dangerous and on the frantic, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, people, and you know, people might even say that are watching this, maybe I have a lot of confirmation bias as well.
Oh, sure.
But I look at literally the scriptures. And then I look at the front page of the news and I'm like, well, I might as well be reading the Bible when I'm looking at the newspaper. You know, that's one thing. But then, you know, saying for talk about confirmation bias, Nostradamus, that's a great, great example of what confirmation bias would look like. You're reading a random quatrain and then going, oh, it must be this because he inferred or implied, or there's this sort of kind of conjecture that matches up over here.
Well,
and I think this is what it means.
Well, and it, you
I
know,
feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's just it. It's one of those, you're using a crowbar to finesse something into place, you know?
Yeah.
And there's, I saw somebody, that was like, oh, I called this. It's like, no, well, number one, no, in November, you said that the Pope died. So you didn't call it. In November, you said he was dead, and he fully wasn't until April. And if you think like you're an amazing seer because, well, you predicted the death of a sickly 88-year-old person.
You know? I think a circus monkey could have predicted that one.
It's like, I think the odds on favorite would have been there. You know, I don't think that's really like a let's get to Vegas real quick and put the money down. You know,
yeah, that's a safe bet.
yeah. So, and sad to say that. But it's one of those, it's interesting to see how fast communities grab hold of things and pull them and use them. And go with them. And once again, that's a lot of what I try to do on this show is demystify things and get to the nitty gritty of it. And understand what these things are about, where these things are rooted from. The idea that, the prophecies of Saint Malachi are not even fully accepted as real.
Yeah, and I don't believe that the Catholic Church has ever accepted them either. No. That's the other thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's not like you have to accept a prophecy for it to be real. But it's one of those, it's been wrong quite a bit too, you know, like you were saying earlier. Yeah. Now, once again, it is a fascinating similarity to see that a Roman of good age will be elected from Nostradamus, and Peter the Roman is who the Pope is supposedly, who is the Black Pope from St. Malachi. We'll see what fruit comes to bear from that and what happens. So, yeah, and once again, the conclave is getting ready to start here in a few weeks, stuff like that. And that is a process that sometimes can take a while.
It can. And, you know, I'm going to be watching that real close. And so I want to warn folks about something. Any religious leader, I'm not just picking on the Pope here.
Yeah.
Literally any religious leader, you need to see what their fruits are. You know, Christ said you'll know them by their fruits. So don't look at them at just how nice they are, how welcoming they are, how much they smile, how loving they are. look at what do they believe? What do they teach? Does it line up with scripture? Does it line up with the tradition of the church? If it does, awesome. And they're producing good works and good fruits and all this other stuff. Hey, that's awesome. That's great. If they're just lovey-dovey, but not producing the fruit, and they're a borderline heretic, run.
Yeah.
Just because they're in a position of leadership doesn't mean that they're the right man for the job. I've known plenty of clergymen that probably should have never been ordained and for sure should never have been consecrated.
Mm.
So it's something to keep in mind. And there is a reason why they call seminary cemetery, because that's where people go for faith to die.
Mm.
So
yeah,
be well aware of that.
Yeah, that is an absolute fact. And that's something that I laud anybody that can make it through and wear the collar. It is not an easy call with any faith. And it's one of those, even entering as a Catholic seminarian, I went through 3 days of intensive psychological background, all kinds of Minnesota multiphasical, all kinds of things, before I was ever even accepted into the seminary. It's not like you just like fill out an application and walk in the next Sunday.
No,
it does not work that way. And yeah, out of probably 25, maybe 25 students that entered my freshman year in the seminary, two of them ended up wearing collars, So it wasn't a whole lot of them. The percentage of who goes in and what comes out is not huge,
It really isn't. No, and if a person feels called to the ministry, double check, that time of self-reflection to see, is this really what I need to do? If you're feeling called or gifted in something else, do that other thing. For me, I didn't have a choice. When I was baptized at the age of, I believe it was 9, I felt the call of God on my life, and I tried to run from it.
Mm.
I was like, nope. I want to make money. I want to do this. I want to do that. But every time, either he slapped me back or life slapped me back on track to the calling. And I didn't have a choice. So I just said, okay, not mine, but your will be done, Lord. And here I am.
Yeah.
Whether good or bad, here I am.
Yeah. And that's just it. It's one of those... It's a hard life to live, period.
It is, once again. And it's lonely.
Yes.
I will tell you, it is a very lonely life to be a clergyman.
Yeah.
Because the inclination in yourself, you want to be the best you can be for your people. At least that should be a big motivating factor.
Yep.
But because of that, you don't have a lot of people you can rely on or lean on to have a good ear. I mean, you can have a confessor, but do they really understand you beyond how you screwed up versus do they know you? And there's very few people that know me, all the intricacies in and outs, all my weirdness, all my quirks, everything else, and still accept me. But that's okay. Because I know I'm doing a work that needs to be done, whether I'm accepted, lauded, who cares?
Yeah.
Do they hate me? Who cares? But you have to, in order to be a clergyman, you have to understand the full thing that goes into being that. It's not sunshines and rainbows. You deal with traumas. I mean, other people's traumas as well. I love doing that. That's why I'm a therapist myself.
Exactly.
But I enjoy helping people walk the journey with them in their life, good, bad, and ugly.
Yeah.
But I don't really have personally anyone I can do that with other than my wife.
Yep.
Which is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that, you know, I don't think a lot of people understand. And I know a lot of people that are very, very close with priests. But I don't think that they grasp that depth unless you're even, I remember even, my mom had a lot to say after I left the seminary. And the only thing I could ever tell her is, I appreciate what you're saying, but you will never have any idea. You never will. You'll never understand. And there's no possible way that you could, because you've never been mm-hmm. through that. And
I will tell you, when I was ordained a deacon, I felt the mantle being placed on me. You know, the bishop was only laying his hands on me, but it felt like a drape of heaviness came on me. It was the weight of responsibility. And that's why the scriptures tell us you shouldn't want to be a teacher in the church, because if you are, you're more strictly held accountable, because it's not just your soul that's on the line. It's everyone else's that you talk to.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what you're talking about and you're leading them astray, their blood's on your hands.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, that is just to bring this conversation full circle in just the right amount of time. That is the job of a prophet.
Yeah.
Is to do that. And that is what we were here to talk about tonight, is that idea of prophecy. Sure is. And how do we root out the difference between prophecy and seeing, or prophecy and prediction, or prognostication? And it really is with that close discernment of heart and mind and soul. Thank you, as always, for coming on, Archbishop. It's always great talking with you. It's always great catching up and talking about these deep, deep topics. Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with you, where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to get their copy of Walking with Ghosts, an exorcist memoir of the paranormal.
Yeah, so my book is on pretty much all of the places where you can get a online book. You can get it in hard format or ebook. I think ebook's actually free. And honest to Pete, I probably make a penny or two per book. So get the free one. You know, five people get my book, I might get 5 cents out of it. So just go sign up for the Amazon Prime, get the free book if you want. My whole mission is to uplift others, to encourage them, to draw them to the cross, draw them to repentance so that they have eternal life. You know, that's my heart. That's my mission. That's who I am. But if they want to get a hold of me, I mean, I have my Facebook page, just James Cloud. But I've pretty much cut out the other websites and such. Mm. So you can email me at bishopcloud@yahoo.com. I check it every few days. So if I don't respond within a day or two, don't feel bad. I get literally thousands of emails.
Yeah.
So it takes a while to go through those. And if I only check it every couple of days, I've got a slew of emails.
Yeah, exactly. So, thank you so much as always. It's always great having you on the show. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. Take care and enjoy the rest of your Easter season.
I shall. You too.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from Archbishop James Cloud, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can go to find all the books, movies, videos, music, everything from our guests, including Archbishop James Cloud. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend Jason McLean from the Siru Papers. We will be diving further into the world of apocalyptic literature further into the world of end time prophecies when we come back right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to our first guest, Archbishop James Cloud, and also thank you to our sponsors, True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like myself, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch here in Austin, Texas, uses Phygeric process to use, reuse, then combust and reuse every part of the hemp plant from seeds to stems to buds to flowers to herb to leaves to roots. Every part is used and reused until nothing remains to provide an amazing CBD product with a full spectrum of benefits as well as terpene profiles. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to use. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your cart of $100 or more. Our guest in this segment is our good friend Jason McLean. He is the founder of the Siru Papers. He is the author of DFW Monsters. We've had him on so many times to talk about so many topics. He's here tonight to join us to discuss end times and end time prophecies. End times. I think a lot of people, Jason, get a lot of things tied up with end times. You know?
Yeah. It's definitely a broad subject.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big topic. It's a thick topic. Even amongst Christian evangelical life, things like that, I think that there is a lot of debate when it comes to end times. So let's go ahead and start cracking this nut open. Where does end times begin? Where do we really get that concept from biblically?
Well, okay, so it's like anything else, right? You get three theologians in a room to talk about end times, you'll get 12 different opinions, right?
Yeah.
So there is this theme throughout Scripture of this concept of the reclaiming of Earth, right? And you could argue that this idea starts in Genesis 3 with the story of the fall, right? The prophecy of the seed of the Shaitan, the snake, Nakash, and Eve, you know, her seed that you'll bruise his head, but he'll crush you'll bruise his heel, yeah, but you'll crush his head. Like there's from day one, there's this point of, okay, things have gotten broken, but we're going to fix it. Like at some point, God is going to fix it. All this and put it right back to square one where he's living, where humanity and God coexist together as one, right?
Yeah.
So that that concept, it's there from the beginning. We sort of have this concept of the end times as a phraseology evolves over the millennia, right? But we do get it from a lot of the writings of Paul, basically when they were talking about, hey, in these days, like we're sort of in this end time period. A lot of this Paul's writing about it. And of course, we're like, well, that was 2,000 years ago. It's like, yeah, because we're in, Paul even say, where we are is a mystery, right?
Yeah.
But there was this goal that God's like, hey, I'm going to hold off on this until we've gotten to a certain point. And again, everyone argues over, well, what is that end point? What's the thing God is waiting on? And it seemed in, like I said, three people, 12 different opinions on that. But the idea is that we are inching ever closer to the point where God's like, all right, we're good. We're done. Let's wrap this up and let's fix this. And again, depending on if you're a preterist or a premillennialist, you know, that could be interpreted a couple different ways. Everyone just sort of agrees Jesus is going to show up and fix this. The question is, does he fix it for 1,000 years and then there's a white throne judgment, or is this the white throne judgment? Everything's fixed forever, right? There's that conversation. But to your question specifically, essentially, this question has always been there, that there is a day coming in the future when God rights our wrong and puts everything where it needs to be. But obviously post, ascension, that's the thing that the New Testament church has been looking forward to while spreading the gospel. And there's a huge theme, shared by actually a lot of different denominations on this, that, quote unquote, the time of the Gentiles, or the thing that's holding back God from, or the reason God is holding his hand back from just fixing all this, is that he's waiting for the gospel to go out to the whole world, for everyone to hear it, to reclaim all of the nations. There's this theme that keeps popping up. You see the number 70 throughout all the Old Testament, and then we see Jesus, you know, sending out 70 disciples, sometimes 72, depends. They're basically the same number. From a numerical perspective. Hmm. And the whole point is that's all of every time you see that, that's an allusion back to the Table of Nations in Genesis 10.
Yeah.
God is saying, hey, it's always been about the whole world. Like the problem that we have is we read the Old Testament through New Testament lenses. And so we miss the connections. Like in Acts, we have, first, you have the coming of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. Well, who's converted there? Jews, but from all over the world, right? So that's Shem. Then the next real big sort of interesting conversion that's recorded is the Ethiopian eunuch, right? Mm-hmm. That's a descendant of Ham. And then you have the house of Cornelius, and Cornelius is Greek. That's Japheth. So embedded in the text is this concept of, hey, this is about the whole world, and that God is trying to reclaim the whole world. He's moving through this. That's why Paul writes about Spain so often in his letters, is that he believes he's supposed to go out to Tarshish or to Spain. That's Tarshish, which is the furthest out on the Table of Nations. Right. So he was looking at his missionary journey theologically. And so he believed that as the apostle to the Gentiles, that's where he would be going. So there's this intertwining of the gospel and the concept of the end times ever since the ascension.
Well,
to try and narrow it down a little bit more specifically.
Well, yeah. And I mean, in addition to that is just the idea that the parousia, the second coming, there's a reason why there was a delay. A lot of people who don't understand biblical history, church history, things like that, don't understand that the apostles fully expected for the parousia to happen within their lifetime.
Yes.
They did not expect to die without the second coming happening.
Yeah.
You know, the book of Revelation was written far after the time of Christ. Even the accounts of Paul are not written up against the time of Christ.
Paul's latest letters are like 62 AD.
Yeah.
So again, you know, not within a year or two, but you know, 30 years later.
Sure.
Most scholars now would date the Gospels to at least before 70 AD, but definitely probably before 64 AD.
Yeah.
Except for, of course, John and Revelation, which was written in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
While he was on Patmos. So,
yeah.
Yeah, there was definitely this expectation that it was supposed to be happening soon. Like, even one of Paul's letters in Thessalonians, he's saying, hey, people are being, you know, these guys are causing trouble because he's saying that the resurrection's already happened, right? So even so, we can see that, right? That everyone fully expected to happen then. So as things got further and further out, they're like, okay, maybe we're missing something here. Maybe there's a point that we're missing, which is why you start getting, you know, Paul writing about the time of the Gentiles, and they're like, oh, okay, we don't know when this is going to happen, but he's delaying for something. This is what you need to be watching out for, which then has sort of created the, you could argue the niche, theology of end times prophecy and trying to interpret it as its own little niche of the theological order.
Well, and, you know, especially much like you said a second ago, the idea of reading Old Testament through a New Testament lens, you know, you tend to crowbar a few things to make that happen. You know, it's kind of like the rife mistranslations in Bibles that are written from Latin, where it's like, wow, nothing in the Bible was written in Latin.
Let me push back on that. Most translations don't use the Latin Vulgate at all, except for as what's called a touch text, meaning let's say you're trying to translate text A into text B or into language B, right? You would use language C, which you already know and have already sort of connected to text A.
Rosetta Stone style.
Right. And so you go, okay, so I've translated into B. Let me see if I can translate B into C. And that way you can kind of make certain that you've matched it up, right? That's really about the only time the Latin Vulgate was ever really used. Because like this is one of those big misnomers. The King James, the first go around, they had their own Greek and Hebrew texts that they were working and translating from. We have better Greek and Hebrew texts now.
Yes.
Because of archaeology, we've got much better texts. And by and large, the arguments over changes or misunderstandings is really overblown. Now, context, though, has changed on a lot of things from the Old Testament, right?
Well, even because content.
Not as much as you would imagine. This is one of the... And again, I would not speak out of class on this one.
Sure.
Like people like Wes Huff are actually experts in that kind of thing. I would point to them. But what we see more often is that we are now beginning to actually understand the context of a lot of these scriptures.
Yes.
It's like, oh, okay, this is why they're saying this weird thing over here. It's because they're using it as a polemic against this neighboring culture, and they're using language that not just they would understand, but the surrounding cultures would understand as a way of throwing shade, right?
Yeah.
Like if we were in March, like let's imagine people 1,000 years from now, we're looking at a newspaper article or an ad, right, that came out in March, and everything's about basketball. Like, why are they talking about basketball to sell cars, right? It would make no sense to them. But we, in our context, would say, oh, it's because it's March Madness.
Yeah.
Right. Or the Super Bowl. That's why everything's themed with football stuff.
Well,
or superheroes. Like, why?
You've got to understand the culture from which the content is being pulled.
Yeah.
And
that's
the cultural lens of that. Now, you know, granted, and when I said content, I'm mainly referring to like Apocrypha, things like that.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the original Bible was curated by the Catholic Church in order to set up a whole quite literal paradigm
Let me, so,
through,
okay,
through which to put things.
And, dude, don't make me defend the Catholic Church here.
And then because, after that, Luther pulled out more things. Then after that, King James pulled out more things. So I remember my uncle at one point being like, what the hell is this book? And I think it was like Bell and the Dragon or something like that.
Which is one of my favorite apocryphal stories.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons and with dinosaurs and all that. But here's my thing. Even those statements are really overstated. And what's happened is there was this sort of movement in the 18th century, 17th and 18th century, really, of I'm trying to think of an easy way to say this. There was an attack on the Bible. And so there was a lot of push to create perspectives on history. To make, and some people, right, like the Catholic Church loves to say, hey, we created the Bible. Any historian today would tell you
they
that's
compiled
insane.
It.
But the Catholic Church the doesn't one. Even, well, but that's the whole thing is the Catholic Church doesn't, it's like, they'll say, well, the Catholic Church will say, well, we existed all the way back to Peter, right? That's their claim.
That is the claim to fame.
That's the claim to fame. Problem is you really can't make that argument of a true Catholic Church until about 1,000 years later. There was a church, right? But mm-hmm. they were in essentially what you had were conclaves of these of churches
yeah.
together, bishops working together. And essentially, my favorite phrase is the Bible wasn't made, it was discovered. There was already unanimity on the text of the New Testament by and large before
Nicaea.
I just forgot his name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone likes to point to Nicaea. Nicaea had nothing to do with the canon at all.
No, no, no. And that's absolutely not. But that is where the articles of faith of the Catholic Church came from. That would be where the Catholic Church first had its first firm foothold as the church as we know it, where it was no longer ancillary cults, mm-hmm. things like that. That was the fight against Arianism and the setup of the full triune God. And the founding of the seven articles of faith that are part of the Nicene Creed that is said
in
every
Mass.
I would
even say that's not really I would still push back. I don't think you don't even really get that as the, not Catholic as in the Catholic Church. Catholic is in universal, yes, but not Catholic as institutional. That really does develop later. But the mm-hmm. point is there's even the whole question between the Deuterocanonical, meaning people who would refer to as what we would call the Apocrypha, mm-hmm. real quick for your listeners, right? Because unless you're a nerd like you and I, most people don't probably know the difference of what we're saying. There are texts that are apocryphal that are not in the Apocrypha.
Yes.
So when we talk about the Apocrypha, we are saying specifically the documents that are what are considered Deuterocanonical, meaning. There are these group of texts that are found in many of the Septuagint collections of the Old Testament, of what we would call the Old Testament, that there's been questions on. They were affirmed by some meetings, disassociated by others. There's always been this argument over many of these books. Even within the Catholic Church, there was questions over a lot of these books. So it's one of those things where the 66 books of the Protestant denominations essentially say these are the ones we know for a fact are that everyone just completely agrees on, right? And then the others, the that make up the 73 books of the I don't even want to call it the Catholic Bible because it's not, because many Protestants use that canon as well over the world, right? So the 73, which includes the Apocrypha, includes things like Bell and the Dragon, Tobit, Maccabees, are the ones that everyone's like, no one really agrees on it.
Yeah. American Standard uses that, New Jerusalem Bible.
Yeah.
Many of them are, printed by the Catholic Church.
Yeah. And it's exactly. But everyone's printing everything. But that's the thing is so when someone says something is of the Apocrypha, there's a difference between an Apocrypha book or a book of the Apocrypha and an apocryphal.
That's
book.
Right.
Because some books are. So again, just kind of trying to, it's like, just because something's apocryphal doesn't mean it's in the Apocrypha. Yeah.
And that's why I popped up the book of Daniel, because of course, the book of Daniel is really like one of the first apocryphal texts, one of the ones that speaks about end times, things like that.
I would suggest
there are parts of the Book of Daniel and other books of Daniel, once again, Bell and the Dragon, things like that, that are Susanna of the Apocrypha. Elders.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
Yeah, it's a complicated, unfortunately, there's a lot of words that sort of sound the same, depends but have on different what a, meanings.
Depends on what the definition of is, Jason.
Yeah, tell me about it. Daniel, it probably something I should have mentioned earlier. Most people just know me from my work on cryptozoology and things like that. I actually have spent, most of my writing is actually on eschatology. And again, to your point, Daniel is one of the first truly apocalyptic books, meaning that it actually works on, speaks about this time of the end. We get a lot of that in Ezekiel as well. But Daniel, I would suggest, is connected to the Book of Revelation in a way that we don't even understand. If you want to understand the Book of Revelation and understand a lot of the symbolism of it, you have to go to Daniel because it's explained in Daniel. And I love that you're in Daniel 12. So right there, it says, let's just go ahead and read it real quick because it's one of my favorite points.
Go for it.
In chapter 12, it says, "Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people," this is Michael, the archangel who is prince over Israel. And something that's only been recently sort of rediscovered by the Western Church through the work of many people, including Michael Heiser, is this concept of the divine council. That essentially there are spirits that go over the nations that we see in Deuteronomy. They get set up there. Bring it back up. I'll just
go ahead.
That concept. Like, that's what Michael's doing, right? He will arise and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. These to everlasting life, but others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who will have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So this is where he's saying, hey, this is where this is all going to happen. Well, later on in that chapter, we see Michael the Archangel standing. And he has got one foot on the sea and one foot on the riverbank. And Daniel's describing, if you read it, you realize he's talking about there's the angel and there's two people in white linen. And this is when he raises his hand and says it'll be time and half a times or 3.5 years, right? Then I, Daniel, looked and behold, two others were standing, one on this bank of the river and the other on the other bank of the river. And one said to the man, dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, "How long will it be until the end of these wonders?" I heard the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, and he raised his right hand and his left towards heaven and swore by him who lives forever that would be for a time and half a time. As soon as they finished shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. That scene plays out in Revelation.
Yep.
But here's the difference. John doesn't record these other men in linen. He's just looking at the big angel. And the reason for that is he was one of the men in linen. Daniel was watching this event play out with John in the future, which means for John's entire life, whenever he would hear the Book of Daniel read sung by the cantor, it was talking about him, and he didn't realize it. So in this idea, we often try and read books in isolation. What we need to do is say, okay, hold on. What's happening in Daniel? What's happening in Zechariah? What's happening in Ezekiel? What's happening in Genesis? What's happening? Like, it's the end of the book, but it's pointing all the way back to the beginning so that we understand who these characters are and what the symbols mean, so that we can understand them. And the question becomes, well, how close are we to the end? Because that's really the whole point, right? Everyone's like, we want to know, so we know, do I need to invest in long-term stocks and bonds, or do I maybe want to do some day trading kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
and that's really where the impetus for end times is just trying to say, okay, well, when are these things going to happen? I've always submitted that it's that we're closer today than we were yesterday.
Yeah.
But that, and again, something I've spent, again, most of my early works on eschatology is about the, is about Revelation 12 and the astronomical alignment that it talks about.
Okay.
And I've always said it can't happen before 2027. That's the only thing I've ever really said. Like, don't get me wrong. Between 2030, maybe 2033, and 2040 is it's a really interesting timeline for me. Gun to my head, it's like, look, you got to put your money down on something. I said, meh, maybe there. But all I've ever been able to say is, I think that the Book of Revelation, chapter 12, the story of the woman who's clothed by the sun, that is a series of astronomical alignments that had its sort of zenith back in 2017, but it doesn't end until 2027. And then all I've ever said is after that, I got no clue. I'm not God. I'm not a date setter. And historically speaking, date setting is a really stupid thing to do, considering Jesus said no one's going to know the day or the hour.
I don't even know the day or the hour.
Yeah. He's like, hey, if Jesus is like, I'm out. Yeah. Right.
Like, I wish I knew. You find out. You let me know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, OK, then you know what I shouldn't be doing? Trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
But he did say that we'll know the season that we're in. And I think that's one of those things where it's like, oh, we really couldn't have seen this even 100 years ago. Even 60 years ago, we really wouldn't have been able to know this, this alignment. So it's like, okay, we're in the season.
Mm.
Okay, then that means we should start looking for an understanding. Closing time's coming, whether you like it or not. Right? And the one point, if there's anything, no matter what you believe on any of this, if there's anything that you take away from what I've been saying tonight, and I'm certain we'll have plenty of other things to say, every day is the end of the world for somebody.
That's right.
Like the all of the questions of the Book of Revelation, of Daniel, they're all put aside by somebody who's now finding out the answer. Armageddon is happening for somebody right now, because that's boom. They're going to God. And so the question is for your listeners is for the state of their souls and the state of the souls of everyone that they meet. It is the end of the world for somebody. We're going to find out how this all plays out one way or the other.
Yeah.
I assure you, everyone's going to find out one way or the other how the story is going to play out. But today's the only day that you got, that you're guaranteed.
That's right.
And for somebody out there, it is the end of the world. Our call is to be the light to the people who are around you at the time you have them, because you are not guaranteed tomorrow. God could wait another 1,000 years to show up.
Yeah.
I don't think he is, but he could. That's his
prerogative.
Call. That's his prerogative. But what I can absolutely guarantee you is somebody is dying right now. Yeah. And we don't know when that is going to happen. So this stuff matters. It does. Like, I'm the first, I focus on the beginning of the book with creation and cryptozoology, and I focus on the end through eschatology, because it's the middle of the book that matters.
Yeah.
Because that's where Jesus is, and that's where we all are.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's a phrase from the Knights of Columbus, Tempus fugit, memento mori. Time flies, remember death. And the whole concept behind that four-word phrase is the idea of the only thing that you have control over is your legacy.
Yep.
What you leave behind, how people remember you, what you've done for the world around you. That's the only thing that you ultimately have any kind of control over. And that's really what a lot of the, once again, the end times texts talk about, is that idea of this is the only thing that you have control over is your path to the end. That's it.
Yep.
You know, and when you start looking, especially at that language, once again, of Daniel, with waters above and things like that is a direct echo to the book of Genesis.
Yes.
100%. And once again, a language that may seem odd, may be trippy to us in today's nomenclature. However, to somebody, to a Jew in that time, that was common everyday talk. And that would have been something that would have been immediately spiritually understood without any question.
Yeah. Well, it's like the sea of crystal in Revelation. Mm. That's you know, that's the firmament. Now, flat earthers don't get overly excited here. That's essentially the my last episode is going to set y'all straight. But it's that sea of glass. Like, that's the whole point is. Yeah, exactly. The entire point of that is that's the thing. Like, God sits on our reality.
Hmm.
That's the entire point. It's like, our reality is so much less than where he is. Michael Heiser has a really great point that so much of the Bible that we get caught up in the rules and regulations. He's like, don't you understand the entire point is God saying, I am not you? That yeah. I am different from you. I am not you. And it's, we like to try and reimagine God to be like us. And it's like, no. He's higher. He's greater. That universe, the area that he inhabits is so much higher than us. We don't understand how it operates. The Imaginary Axis, great channel on YouTube. It's a comic book thing, so guys, don't worry. Like, you don't need to run over there if you don't want to, but I love his work. He does a lot of stuff on comic books. He has this really great metaphor that of sort of trying to say the difference between a higher dimensional reality versus ours, right? And it's, imagine trying to talk to Mario from the original 8-bit 2D scroller, right?
Yeah.
And just imagine you sit there and you could talk to him. You say, why don't you just go around the Goombas and the Koopas and the pipes? He'd look at you like, what are you talking about? That word would mean nothing to his existence. It would be like a higher dimensional being, an angel asking us, why don't you just move septward?
Yeah.
Sept meaning seven, right? We'd be like, what are you talking about? We can't move
seven dimensions.
Mean? Yeah, we can't move in seven dimensions, but they can.
Yeah.
So much of this is saying, hey, your reality is less than mine. This is God saying, your reality is less than mine. Time is different from me. Just trust this is all going to work out. And so much of this language is saying, hey, he's higher. There's a bigger story happening here that we can't understand. And what's funny is we get glimpses of that story and then it's like, yeah, you're not going to get it. Just let's focus on the things you can handle right now. Seems to be this common theme. It's just like, hey, you're going to get a look into this universe and realize you can't understand it. So please stop trying. Can you focus on your neighbor, on helping those around you, on, you know, not trying to
what be you do have bag. Control over?
Yeah. Again, the things you can control.
Yeah.
But just saying, hey, we're going to tell you the end of the story so that you know it plays out and it's okay. We win in the end. It's fine. It's all okay.
Yeah.
But do focus on today, on the people around you, because that's your job is in the here and now. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that is a huge message of a lot of biblical text when it comes to those things, which is once again why it's like, you know, take care of yourselves here, take care of yourselves now, take care of yourselves spiritually, make sure that you're ready, things like that, because there are all kinds of biblical warning, all kinds of things that people interpolate out of the text as doom. Death saying, you know, and don't get me wrong, you're talking some pretty wild stuff in the book of Revelation,
you know,
and what's really funny is not too long ago, I'm speaking at the Psy Games this year, very, very much looking forward to it. I posted a thing on social media about the Psy Games, their ad for me to speak, and I boosted it. And it wasn't until I saw my brother's notification that my brother commented on my Psy Games post. And I was like, oh, let me go see what my brother said. And his only comment was, wow, these comments are gold. And I was like, oh, well, what are these comments? Yeah. And I got to reading. And brother, I mean, it got to the point of me being demonic because of remote viewing. Because
well,
of things,
purple glasses,
because so. Of things like, even talking about psychic ability or the possibility of it. And I'm like, this guy went off on a page long rant about the book of Revelation. And I was like, you mean by John of Patmos, who quite possibly remote viewed the end of time. Okay, noted. Because it was once again a revelation, an unpeeling of his eyes and his reality to a different view of something else. You know, is it a direct translation, a note for note? None of this is note for note. If it was note for note, we would have the exact same story amongst three gospels of the call of, you know, where Jesus says the exact same thing at the same place. But instead, what you have is one author of a gospel writing for a specific audience who this thing may not translate to whatsoever because it's a nomenclature that they don't know or use.
Yes. So actually, I was just dealing with this this last weekend. It'll play into the next month's. Yeah, this month's or next month's, I guess, whenever this comes out.
Tuesday.
It's last Sunday. Yeah, last Sunday. So the next month, at the end of May, last Sunday of every month is when I put it out. I'll be dealing with, with Leviathan and the chaos dragons and the imagery, right?
Sure.
And so the story of Jesus, you know, going, calming the sea, right? He rebukes it. That story it's not that the story itself necessarily plays out differently, but like which stories are put before and after it. Yeah. It's interesting because each gospel is trying to tell the story differently, trying to make a different point, right?
Yeah.
There are definitely points of commonality, but they're trying to tell different stories, and they don't. And the thing is, the Bible is written by people who don't think like we do. And in a lot of ways, we are the modern brain is simply too hardwired for direct language to understand the way that they were trying,
the way it was communicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're trying to tell you things that we would pick up in poetry or if we were to read it. Michael Heiser is really great, is great on a lot of this. He talks about just read it like it's a fiction book.
That's right.
It doesn't mean read it as if it's untrue, but if you are reading a book, a novel, you expect there to be foreshadowing. You expect there to be themes that recur and you're supposed to compare and contrast.
Yeah.
This event with this event. Like that's how these books are arranged. That's how the stories are arranged. And so in the same way, we're supposed to look at everything that happens and say, okay, where is all this foreshadowed? Right? Where is John, the Revelator, when he's looking at all this? Why does the dragon have seven heads? Yes, I think there's a metaphorical meaning to it, and there's a ton of things we can talk to, but it's also it touches on Leviathan, which is a playoff of Lotan or Lutanu, which had seven heads, the chaos dragon. Like there's this connection that goes all the way back to Genesis that allows you to say the dragon of Revelation is the serpent from Genesis. And it's not that John is just randomly making it up, right? There is this common theme throughout the text that we miss because we're reading it, in a different language. But we're also not reading it the way they would have. We're missing the nuance of a lot of these things. But back to your point about the supernatural, this is one of my great pet peeves. I think I've said it here on the channel. One of the things that really annoys me is that often Christians claim to believe that there's a supernatural being that supernaturally created the universe, sent his son, who was a supernatural being, who died and rose for your sins supernaturally, and then sent the Holy Spirit, which is a supernatural being, to live within you, and you don't want to talk about the supernatural.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like at a certain point, I'm sorry, the math ain't mathing on that.
Well, it's no different than a problem. It's no different than the priest that told me that whenever I was grabbed by a shadow being we don't really have a teaching on that, Chris. Like, so you're going to tell me that dark things are stalking my soul around every corner and that I'm to accept evidence of the accept spectral evidence upon faith. And when provided evidence of the spectral, you have no faith in it.
Yeah.
And that's a jump of the shark that I can no longer make. Sunday basis, you know?
Yeah. What's worse is if you were to travel back again, any denomination, about 120, 140 years, they'd have had something for you on that.
Yeah.
They absolutely would have.
Absolutely. Because
it's really been in, over the last century that we've rejected the supernatural worldview. And I, again,
yeah,
not to get overly conspiratorial, I think that was by design so that it could be reintroduced later on. Mm-hmm. Right. Again, I'm not even talking about humans. Again, I think we're in a fight with a supernatural being that's a heck of a lot smarter than the rest of us.
Been around a little longer.
Yeah. And I think he understands, like, hey, you know, what's the line from, you know, the line from The Usual Suspects, right? The greatest trick the devil ever played is making people think he didn't exist.
That's right.
If you can make people believe that the supernatural doesn't exist, then you get, within two generations, people have no concept for it.
This
is my great lack, or one of the great regrets that I have, is we're having to create new language to describe these things because we got rid of all the old language that we had for it.
Yeah.
But then when you get to bring it back, and then you can control the narrative. Because I'm a huge believer in the Worf-Saphir hypothesis, that if you don't have a word for something, you can't understand that thing. And so I think what we're doing is we're coming into, again, I think a lot of this was preparation because he's like, okay, this last little bit is coming up. I need to find a way to hide so that they don't recognize me when I show up again. Right. So that you don't know me when I come. I think we've been set up, and I think but I also think the awakening that we're seeing right now with people actually having these conversations, and we're finding, through archaeology, we're discovering these ancient contexts. It's giving us language to have a better conversation. I don't think it's a coincidence. And something I talked about on yesterday's Siri papers. Let me pull up the actual text myself so I can read it.
Go ahead.
It's First Timothy 4:1-2. He says, now this is Paul writing. Now, the Spirit expressly states that in the latter times, some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits, teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared. And it's that last line, through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared. That has really, really hit me hard over the last week. Working on that video, because it feels so true to where we are today.
Yeah.
Right. It's everyone, when you talk about end times, it's always about, you know, hail, burning hail falling from skies and locusts with golden crowns coming out of the abyss and all of these things. Right. And it's easy to see why people would want to talk about that, because it's sexy, right? It's dramatic. The thing about the end times that keeps popping up all throughout is people are going to be lying.
Insincerity.
They're going to hate their fellow man. Peter talks about it. It's like there'll be scoffers, right? Second Peter 3, right? Starting in verse 3, knowing this first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful desires. They will say, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. They deliberately overlooked the fact that the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these, the world that existed was deluged with water and perished. But by the same word of heavens, by the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. So it's like, even Peter's like, hey, when the time comes, it's going to be full of scoffers, people who don't believe God created the universe and that he's going to bring it to an end. Right.
Yeah.
That they're going to say, hey, it's never going to happen, right? And we live in an age of scoffers. We live in an age of people with seared consciences. We live in a world where nobody cares,
well,
right?
Yeah, that idea of the seared conscience, especially, the idea mm-hmm. that something is so branded in your mind that there is no room for change or flexibility. It's literally no different than the teaching of the willow and being as supple as a willow, you know, so that you can bend and move with the wind and not crack and break. Like, it's great to be a strong oak, but it don't bend much.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really move it breaks instead. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at those things, because, yeah, it is repeated over and over again that is going to be the case, that society and the people will get to the fact that they're basically bullheaded. They will not listen to anything else. They will choose their prideful action despite anything.
And they will lead people. They will knowingly lie to lead them astray, because they just don't care, because there's money, there's power, there's something in it for them that's not for the people that they're leading, right? Again, I wrote four books that they're all one book now as the Tetralogy, about interpreting the Book of Revelation. And yeah, it's all about the big sexy things, right?
Well,
but the biggest point is we're going to find all that out at the end.
Yeah.
The real thing is, if we are where I think we are, then we need to be looking around realizing, oh, there's a lot of people who are out here to hurt us. There's a lot of people that we shouldn't be listening to, because they're very clearly out for themselves and they're not out for you. We're supposed to look around and say, how do I help my fellow man?
Yeah.
We're supposed to be the Good Samaritan. We're supposed to be bringing the gospel to the world.
Yeah. We're supposed to be the innkeeper. That allows the Holy Family in, things like that. And you know, once again, these things are echoed throughout the Bible. They are echoed throughout not only seasons, but generations of the Bible. And a prime example of that, like you can see in Revelation 4, where once again, we're talking about the sea of glass, like crystal around the throne with four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The living creature was like a lion. And that is a direct callback to the book of Ezekiel and Ezekiel's wheels and the four creatures and the topaz. It is a direct callback to that. So once again, these things are written for an audience that were more than familiar with the original text. You know, whereas we casually read the Bible, things like that. Like, this was a point of faith that the Jewish people lived on a daily basis.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, we'll talk about the Ezekiel's wheels eventually, probably sooner rather than later over on Siru. But flash forward, not UFOs. Way overstated. Most people, when they do that, they omit like 60% of the chapter that's describing things. So in fact, the matter is, though, these four beings, those are the cherubim, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that the reason they're using those symbols is their astronomical alignments, or their astronomical points. The lion is literally Leo. The bull is Taurus, right? There's question over who the eagle is, but one's the human. Like, it's the four cardinal directions.
The eagle would likely be Cygnus.
Yeah. Cygnus is, again, there's arguments over it, but we'll let it, again, not, we don't have to get too deep into it, but the thing is, the cherubs, or cherub back in the day, the cherubs were literally called the pillars of the sky. They were the things that held up the firmament. They were the four cardinal directions, right? Yeah. So when we look at it, it's like, that's not me saying that the cherubs don't exist. They do. But the way that they are described, the way they are presented, is to tell us something, right? It is to give us a broader context as to what we're looking at here and what this is and their importance. And this is where we tend to forget. In the Old Testament, stars are angels, like just straight up. Yeah. That's how they were viewed. It's not that stars don't exist. It's just they looked up and you're like, okay, these are the brightest things I can see. Right. They're up there. We can't go up there. They were symbols of the divine. That's how they were understood. And so there's a lot of these layers to the language that we over materialize instead of understanding the broader message that's being made.
Yeah.
And we miss it.
Yeah, precisely. And I mean, even whenever you look at the old school map from Hebrew tradition of the earth itself, with Sheol and the pillars of the earth and everything else in the firmament. It's one of those, like, it's a, the way I always explained it whenever I taught religion and spirituality to CCE for the Catholic Church to junior high and high school students for a decade was you have to imagine these stories as basically stories being told around a campfire about a culture, about the things that have happened, mm-hmm. you know, and eventually somebody wrote those stories down. You know, and that's what we are looking at is the final version of this story. And from there, we get to deconstruct it. We get to go back. We get to look at archaeology. We get to look at history. We get to look at the history of the Jewish people and see where these things came from and see what their source material is and things like that.
Because who are they talking to?
Other source material. Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
Well, so – okay, real quick, just because since I did the whole flat earth thing, pull that picture back up if you still have it. You'll notice the thing no one ever talks about is the sun and the moon in this model go under the earth. They travel through the underworld and come out the other side.
That's right. That's right.
Like they never, no one ever Very talks Egyptian. About this.
Very Egyptian. Yeah.
Well, and again, that's how everyone viewed it, and which would make sense,
absolutely.
Right? How does the sun, moon, the stars, how do they move? They go up, over, and then down from our perspective, right?
They disappear at their horizon.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense to look at them and have that interpretation. You know, if you're living in the Bronze Age, like that's exactly what it would be. Well,
and that's why it's a hemisphere.
Yeah.
Not a full sphere.
Right.
You know, that's all you understand is the dome that you see over you.
Yeah.
And it
makes perfect sense how they would come to this, you know, it's observationally much truer than the modern flat earth movement, which has to deny what you actually see. But like I said, don't want to get too off on that.
No.
Watch the video.
No.
But to your point, this is, again, something that came out of the really got popularized in the 19th century is this idea of once we started getting more and more of the ancient writings, like, oh, well, the authors of the Bible were just copying these other texts, right? The problem is, again, most scholars today would look and say, yeah, that's not what's happening.
No.
Right? This is one of the most overstated perspectives that's talked a lot about on the internet, where it's like, oh, they're just copying it immediately out of the Enumeration. It's like, okay, but where? Because there are concepts that are there, but they're all superficial, right?
Yeah.
Everybody borrowed
off of everybody.
Well, it's more like they were working out of the same cultural milieu, right?
Yep.
It's rather, you know, it's sort of like why comic books, when again, comic book guy, right? You have a lot of, the Challengers of the Unknown and the Fantastic Four. They're basically the same characters with some differences. Well, were they copying off of each other? No, they were all artists and writers living in the same place, in the same positions, trying to tell the same kind of story. So there's going to be similarities. X-Men and, I just forgot the name of the team. The DC literally just did a series about them, the Robot Man. It's going to drive me nuts. I can literally see the comic book. Anyway, so there's these two teams. You have the X-Men, obviously led by Charles Xavier, who's in a wheelchair. And these are all heroes who were born different, but they, you know, one has wings and one looks like an ape. But then you have DC's version, and they come out like with only like a couple months apart. Their leader is a guy in a wheelchair, and they're all sort of freaks of nature.
Yeah.
And it would be very easy to say, oh, so they're just, they're copying off each other. It's like, no, the publication essentially is the same time. Well, it's more than that. It's just, they're coming out of the same milieu, right? Yeah. Right. And that's all that this is, is that you have cultures, they're touching on one another. They're coming out of the same milieu, but what the Bible really specifically is doing, the biblical authors, is that they're throwing shade at the surrounding cultures.
Mm-hmm.
They're using, like when they use a title for God that's usually used for Baal Hadad, they're saying, no, it's not Baal Hadad, it's Jehovah. right? Or Yahweh, whichever one you want to go with. There's a long conversation on that, right? When it talks, you know, it's like there's this, again, people whose consciences are seared are knowingly lying about saying, oh, they're just copying. No, they're not copying. They're working within a culture. And they're, because when it's the differences that make the difference. I forget who said that originally. It's not mine. I wish I could take credit for it, right? It's like Wesley Huff did say this. It's like if you have two pills and you have a headache, one's aspirin, one's arsenic, right? They're both two little white pills with A's on them.
Yeah.
That doesn't make them the same thing because it's the differences that make the difference, right?
Yeah.
It's they have differences of opinion as to why things happen too. And that's a really big catalyst for the differences between them, right?
Yeah.
Like the law of the Old Testament is actually saying no one's above the law, whereas the law of all the surrounding cultures was I'm the king and I make the laws, right?
Yeah.
And it's over here, man is just accidentally created by the splitting of the chaos dragon. Over here, there is no chaos dragon that was actually slain because God didn't have to. And people were created with a purpose, right? Well, it's the same thing with eschatology. Everyone's eschatology, there's an end of the world for every culture. But the story of the Bible is the world is set. It's not the end of the world. It's that the world is actually set right. Going back to your point that everyone likes to, you know, they read Revelation. And the thing I hear a lot is it's so scary. Because there's so much going on, and it's very scary. I'm scared of the book, and I'm like, why? The book is about the fact that we win.
Well, and also the fact of, once again, people are reading that in isolation.
Yeah.
They are not reading it, I'd love to say, the surrounding text, but there's nothing else after Revelation.
Yeah, the surrounding text is the rest of the Bible. That, so.
You've got to have, once again, the full polished lens. You can't have a veneer of a lens or anything like that. You have to have a full understanding of the prophet of Daniel. You have to have a full understanding of Ezekiel. You have to have a full understanding of Peter. You have to have a full understanding of all of these things, the cultural significance of what was going on, the audience that they were written for, and the audience in which John of Patmos was living, and the world that he was living in as a persecuted Christian. When he wrote all of these things as an echo of those to give hope to those who were persecuted.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
But if you just read it like it's a book off the shelf, like you went out and bought the latest Dean R. Kuntz book, I could see how you might get a little freaked, man. You know?
Yeah. No, exactly. Sorry, my internet had just a tiny bit of a hiccup there, so I may have missed one or two things you said. But yeah, if we miss the fact that it's like, hey, he's writing to people in persecution.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not a preterist, right? Someone who believes that basically everything's already happened up until the returning of Christ. I'm not a preterist because even Paul says, right, that the Antichrist is destroyed by the breath of his coming. So it's one of those things where the Antichrist has not come. But that being said, the people who were living through that persecution, they could look at this and say, okay, I see what's happening around me. This is very, which is why I think a lot of people, it's so easy for them to say, well, this has to be the end of times because this looks like what I'm seeing in the book and I'm seeing it happen around me. Yeah, because that's the whole point. It's God through John is writing to people in persecution. And he's writing to let them know it's going to be okay. And that once all of these horrors are over, it goes back to being Eden, where we're living with God without this separation. There is no more, there is no more chaos. Like specifically when it talks about at the very end of the book, and it's talking about how New Jerusalem has come down and it's on the earth and God and man are living as one, right? It talks about how there's no more sea. I have up until very recently, I thought it was literally just saying there's no more oceans. And I was like, well, maybe that's just so there's plenty of land for, you know, maybe there's some rivers and stuff. It's like, no, dummy, it's the chaos dragon. The whole point of there not being a sea means there's no chaos dragon. There's no chaos anymore.
Yeah. There's no more abyss.
Order. Yeah, there's no more abyss. It's all gone.
That's right.
All of that's gone. It's just God and man in a perfect world. And again, the angels as well. And everyone's just hanging out the way it was supposed to be. God's family is fully united at the end.
Yeah.
It's an end to man's inhumanity against man. It's an end to our you know, being the usurper of the Chaos Dragon, which is Satan, in his control over mankind's nations. Like, that's all gone. It's all gone. This is the way it's supposed to be. It's a restoration. And that's why Revelation is ultimately important. It's just letting you know, hey, we win in the end, and it's gonna be okay.
Yep.
It's gonna suck. And you know, if you live through it, great. It's gonna suck for a little bit, but it's good at the end. But guess what? The last 2,000 years have sucked pretty hard too. And you're supposed to get through, because we're gonna find out eventually what all these things mean.
Yeah.
The only thing that matters is we win. And so again, focus on today.
Well, and that's just it. You know, especially we have a hard time looking at it in with the longevity lens, Jason. But when you're talking about people like John of Patmos, things like that, most of these people were converted Jews. They were Judaic, who converted to Christianity from the Messianic prophecy, you know? And when you're talking about these ideas, we have to remember that. That's why these things call back to the Book of Daniel. That's why these things call back to the Old Testament and directly back to the waters and the abyss and things like that, because these were stories that, once again, they already knew and that were ingrained in them. So you didn't have to reteach the idea, you know, to make the comic book example. It's like it's not like a Batman movie where the first 30 minutes has to be the origin story every single time.
Dude,
you don't need to spend the first 30 minutes on how he became Batman. We got it.
Right.
We got it.
We know. So let's take it further. It's like, if we see a character in a red cape, we kind of know the direction they're going with, right?
Yeah.
This is either a hero character or it's a deconstructed anti-hero character where it's like, he's the bad guy, right? Like Omni-Man, right?
Yeah.
For those who've seen Invincible. Omni-Man is clearly supposed to be Superman, and he has the red cape. So it's like, oh, red cape. We know what the power sets are. We know.
Yeah.
But he's the bad version, right?
Yeah.
Way overplayed, but it's still a good show. But it's like, so when we see superhero language brought into as a commercial or whatever, the symbology is already there.
That's right. We know
what's being said. We know what's being communicated.
Well, and you know,
and it's the same thing for them.
And that's the archetype, you know, and that's why, to go back to what you were talking about, how no, they aren't necessarily pulling from source material. No, they're pulling from an archetype. These are archetypes that exist across humanity and across cultural barriers, and using those archetypes is how you convert other tribes that you come across and things like that.
It's a communal language.
Yeah.
So that people can actually, again, the point of language is to convey one idea to another person.
That's right.
Right. And back and forth.
Yeah.
And so you want to use symbols and iconographies that they understand, that everyone is coming on the same milieu. They have the same viewpoint. Again, this is why mountains are so important. Why? Because that's where God is, right? The divine is on the top of the mountains. I saw this meme, and it's like you want to laugh, but you also want to slap people until your hand hurts, and then slap them for making your hand hurt. Where they're like, if you ever feel stupid, just understand that the Greeks believed that their gods were on a particular mountain and never bothered to go up and check. It's like, okay, it's funny at first. But how profoundly stupid is, like, they didn't mean it necessarily, like they were just literally sitting up there. Well, first of all, they couldn't climb to the top anyway. Back then, you just couldn't, because again, they didn't have the ability to do that. But they didn't think they were literally sitting there.
Yeah.
It's the touchstone. It's the point where they knew that supernaturally, that's where their beings were. It's like, stop believing everyone who lived before you was dumber than you are.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
But everyone understood what being on the mountain means, right? Because that's right. Where the gods are. That's where the divines are. Yeah, that's where
being that elevated is. Above being
right.
Yeah.
And again, that's what the water is. The ocean is chaos. That's where people don't live, right? They're the extremes of people don't live in the ocean and people don't live on top of mountains. And so that's one became the symbol of chaos. One became the symbol of the divine. Everyone had the same concept. And so they were using those concepts to communicate ideas.
Absolutely.
And thoughts.
Absolutely. And, you know, once again, you have to understand those things. Once again, the great example would be poetry, epic yeah. poetry, things like that, where mm-hmm. it is rife with symbolism that you have to understand. And that's why the footnotes are there in most yeah. Bibles. And that's
yeah. yeah.
what
read
the glossaries
the people,
are for.
They're there
read
for
the
a reason.
Footnotes.
Someone put a lot of time into it. That's all I'm saying, right? It's like, don't let that go to waste. And again, it's like with Revelation, there's a lot of Roman esque visuals yes. there, right? Again, why? They lived during the time of Roman
he
occupation.
Was being persecuted by Rome.
Yeah. It's like it's really kind of obvious to see why they would use that language, right?
Absolutely.
So it's like just understand the context. And it's not necessarily, and again, if y'all read the Tetralogy, I don't think that the Whore of Babylon is Rome. Right? And I explained specifically why I don't.
It's us.
But I'm yeah, well, there's more to it. But the simple fact of the matter is, like, it is a specific city. But the whole yeah. point is, we're all evil. That's the whole point. But yeah, there's a lot of Roman imagery because that's the time when they lived, right? There's always, if John were writing today, there'd be a lot of stuff about limousines and airplanes. And yeah. he'd talk about Air Force One or whatever, right? Like, yeah. There would be stuff where... It's not that he's saying that's what happens. It's the imagery that's there. So we understand, oh, this is oppression. This is, again, going all the way back to Nimrod, right? Like, this is all the same stuff. It's all the same story being told.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is future. It's a lot closer than it was yesterday. But if you want to understand Revelation, if you want to understand end times, you kind of have to go back through the rest of the book.
That's right.
Because that's the setup. That's the... But the ultimate punchline is the only punchline that matters is God wins. It's all good. It doesn't matter. Like if you're martyred tomorrow, that's not a failure.
Yeah.
Right. Like everyone's like, well, what happens if I lose everything? And it's well, then you're still fine. Like, I don't understand. Like, it's yeah. like, stop. He who dies with the most stuff still dies. Right.
That's right. That's right.
Your God's victory over evil is won by God, not yeah. necessarily by us, through us to yeah. a point, yes, but he's the one who wins.
Yeah, die on your own terms if you want. You're still yeah. dead.
You're still dead.
Still dead.
It's like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like, look, this is going to get ugly, but life gets ugly. God's right. going to be there at the end. It's fine. Don't get lost in the material concepts of this world. So often people are worried, it's like, but what if I, you know, or can we lose? Because you're looking at yourself, you're looking at your power and not the power of God. And yeah. that's the biggest mistake. The entire point of Revelation is he's the one doing it. Again, yeah. going back to the beginning, there was no chaos dragon to slay. He's slain at the end. If you want to use Isaiah as sort of the, you know, so that's the whole point is God's going to take care of all that for you.
Yeah.
Right.
And
your job is in the here and now. And guess what? If you got to lay it all on the line, lay it all on the line. It's perfectly okay. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, I wish I had like ASCAP rights because that'd be the perfect song to go out with.
Fair enough.
Little triumph yeah. on the way out. Uh-huh. Nice little double entendre there. But in all sincerity, it is the fact of that. That is what. Any book of Daniel, what have you, that is what any of these apocalyptic texts are truly about, is be strong in your faith and know that mm-hmm. you are doing right. Know that, you know, you need to do the right thing because you don't know when it's coming. You don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. Once again, even even to reiterate the words from the son himself. I don't even know. Yeah. You find out, you let me know when the end is coming. But until then, do right, be right. One of the things I tell my son every morning as he walks out the door is the Rasta concept of walk good. Walk good. Go out into the world, be the best you can be. You do right for people no matter what. You go out, you do what you know is right.
Yeah.
And then you come home. You know, but walk good. And that's really what all of these apocalyptic texts, Book of Revelation, Daniel, Peter, that's what they're all about, is walk good. Be the best you can be, and sit firm in the knowledge that, you know, come the end, the good will win. The meek will inherit the earth, you know. So, and it's one of those folks that most of you who listen to the show, if any of you are new to the show, I am a former Catholic seminarian. I was a 10-year youth minister, all kinds of stuff. I am not a church-going practitioner anymore. I don't go to church with my family, things like that. But we have these conversations all the time, Jason. You know, and I love still to this day having the biblical back and forth, talking about these things. Because if you don't understand it, you are purposefully blinding your eyes to understanding a good 60% of the world around you, of the people around you. You've literally shut your door to a point of empathy and to a point of connection that you, whether or not you believe what's in the book, understanding it helps you understand that person, helps you understand what they think, what they believe, why they believe it, and lets you understand the fact of you should just accept them and their paradigm as the unique, and I'm going to use the word snowflake. but in the proper scientific sense of snowflake, where it's like, find two that are alike, good luck, they exist, but your odds are one in a million, one in a billion to find that. So yes, we are unique snowflakes when it comes to what we believe, why we believe it, even when you're talking about the person in the pew next to you on Sunday.
Yeah.
You came to that through different means. You came to that through different astatic ways of moving spiritually to flex and move to that point. And we all need to learn to understand that point of empathy. And that's why I love having these conversations with you.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why I love coming on the show. Actually, my favorite version of this, and I won't take too long, is
go.
There's a story that we miss in the Old Testament, which is comparing, contrasting, right? The first two tyrants named in the Bible, Nimrod and Pharaoh, what do they do? They make the people make mud bricks, right? Mud bricks, perfect metaphor for humanity, right?
That's right.
But when God asks for the Hebrews to make their altars, right? He specifically calls out unhewn stone. Why? Well, because there's a story being told there. Cultures, they want you to be a brick, literally a brick in the wall, right? Mud is just, it's water and it's dirt and it's put together and it's all uniform. No one thing matters. Everything's the same. But unhewn stone requires dry masonry, meaning every piece is unique.
That's right.
All those rocks came out of the same rock face. They're made out of the same material, but they're all different shapes and different sizes. So when you put them together, every single piece matters. God's telling us the kingdoms of man, i.e., which ultimately means Satan, is going to turn you into a brick in the wall. Just like everyone else, everything has to be the same and you don't matter. But in the kingdom of God, every person is unique, different, and they matter, and they are integral to the whole.
Yeah.
Those are the two different views of humanity. Either you're worthless and you're just another piece of brick to be bought and sold, or you are something that is important and unique to the kingdom.
Yep.
Those are the only two views of humanity that exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a great example to go out on, Jason. The idea that, yes, we are all unhewn stone. You know, we are all unique, and integral to the foundation of humanity is our uniqueness. So thank you as always for your time, my friend. It's always great chatting with you. It's always great catching up. It's always great really deep diving into these really, really deep topics with you. Where can people go to follow you? Where can they go to like, subscribe? Where can they go to find your art? All that kind of good stuff.
So at some point, I swear I'm going to put the serialpapers.com back up. Uh-huh. I swear I just have to do that. And it's going to be, what's worse is it's just going to be links to my YouTube page and my Rumble page and then my author's page. But yeah, you can go to, you can find Siru Papers, S-I-R-U Papers at Rumble or on YouTube, or you can follow me on Facebook and Instagram and on X as well. I'm there throwing, you know, links and the occasional random thought that crosses my brain.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there they are right there, folks. Stop on by. Follow Jason. He has some great worldviews and honestly is one of the most open and amazing people I know when it comes to these topics and when it comes to really looking at things, not only with a proper scientific eye, but with a proper skeptic's eye, where it's a capital S and you're always looking for the data that will change your mind.
I appreciate that. I'm ruggedly sexy. I'm also one of the most attractive friends you have. Yeah.
It's absolutely true. You really do make me shine whenever I'm next to you. your brilliance is just all encompassing. You take care, my friend. We'll talk to you soon. Hold the line real quick while we close out with the audience. Well, you are online checking out everything from Jason McLean and Siru Papers, folks. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store, full of tons of binaural beat music by yours truly. I actually just put out a new album specifically for remote viewers. So if you're a remote viewer out there, stop on by and check out the new album Remote Viewer by Christopher Jordan. You can also find your link to Curious Research there, and you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFO, UAP, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your back pocket data log to record all of your data and your experiences as they happen in the field in real time. That way your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day it needs to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.